My name is Audrey Denny. I'm an educator and a farmer, and I live here in Chico, California.
Obviously, you're seeking office because you feel the North State can be better represented. Can you explain three key policy areas where you think you'll be more in step with local voters than incumbent Doug LaMalfa?
So I'm going to start by telling you a little story. The reason that I got into this race was in December, late last year, when it became evident that the tax bill was going to pass. And in the dead of night, Congress was going to rewrite our tax code with little to no thought about everyday working class Americans. I got fired up. And I got especially fired up when I learned that Representative LaMalfa was one of 11 key Californian votes that was going to make that happen. And that really was the moment for me that I decided to jump into this race. Because the fact of the matter is Representative LaMalfa represents the wealthiest among us and a very small group of constituents. And our district, California's beautiful first district, deserves a representative who cares about every single person in this district and will represent every single person. Your question was three key priority areas. I think the first one, the most obvious one for me is I'm going to fight for and I'm going to work for everyday regular Americans. And I'm going to advocate for a tax code that fairly treats our regular and middle class Americans, that makes sure that they get the bulk of tax cuts and make sure that we still have room in our federal budget, in our coffers, that there's money in that budget to make sure that people who are working hard at the county levels have the resources that they need to get the job done. A tax system that works for everyone, that treats regular and middle class Americans well. I told you right away that I was an educator, and so my second key policy area is education. I so believe in the ability of education to get young people started off on the right foot and to get them ready to be productive citizens. I'm a big advocate for career and technical education. I'm a product of career tech ed. I went through my high school ag program, and I got both of my degrees in agriculture here at Chico State. I say here because as we're sitting in the studio, I'm looking across at beautiful Chico State's campus. And so I'm a big, big proponent of career and technical education. But besides just my personal love of that program, I've seen, as I've been traveling around the district for the past 5 months, I've seen that our community colleges really are the economic drivers in our counties and in our communities. And so as your representative, I would make sure that I would be fighting for and supporting, fully funding, fully staffing all of our community colleges and making sure that they're responsive to the needs in our communities so they can be preparing students for jobs right there in the communities. So we talked about a fair tax code. We talked about education. And the third big issue on my mind that I believe separates me from Representative LaMalfa is healthcare. And healthcare is a huge, huge issue. But for me, it really comes down to when someone's sick, do they go to the hospital? Are they afraid of the medical bills? Are they afraid of the quality of care? Is there a hospital for them to go to? One of my friends, just last week, walked into my campaign office in downtown Chico and said, "Audrey, I think I'm having a heart attack." And I said, "Oh," he was pale, so pale, but keeled over. And I said, "Oh my gosh, we have to get you to Enlo. We got to get you seen." And he said, "No, I can't go. I don't have insurance. I can't afford that." And for me, that it was just emblematic of our broken healthcare system. Our healthcare system is designed to provide massive profits to insurance companies and massive profits to drug companies. And it's not designed to make sure that every single person has access to quality healthcare. And so on a national level, I'll be advocating for a Medicare for all type system or a single payer system where we can actually decrease the cost of our healthcare spending and also focus on prevention and make sure that every single person gets the same quality of care. But here in the First District, we also have a lot of challenges related to healthcare in a rural sense. When you go outside of Chico, you go outside of Redding, it's hard to find doctors. It's hard to train and keep doctors right here in our communities. Most of our district is a medically underserved area. So being innovative and thinking about how we recruit and retain doctors and nurses and EMTs in our rural areas is really, really essential as well. So those are the three things that I'm hoping to bring and to focus on in Washington.
Illegal immigration and cannabis seem to have joined abortion and firearms as wedge issues in a supposed culture war across the nation. Where do you stand on each of these issues, and how much latitude should states have to set their own rules?
That's a great, great question, Mark. So I want to take a second and frame this up for you, because I believe right now, we as a society, we as a country, we as even communities and families are, we've allowed ourselves to become so, so polarized on all of these issues. And we've allowed these wedge issues to define us. And so when you are either pro-gun or you are anti-gun, you are pro-cannabis or you are anti-cannabis, pro-immigration or anti-immigration, and those wedge issues we have allowed to define us and to push ourselves back into these hyper-partisan corners. And for me, when I look at that, I see this hyper-partisanship, this polarization as one of the major threats facing our democracy right now. And so every single day on the campaign, we're talking about and we're identifying, how do we put people before party? How do we put love of country above all else? And how do we come out of these corners and find shared common values with people who might have a different party affiliation than us or a different view on some of these issues? And then how do we make real change from there? So when I talk about these issues, I always start by talking about what are the shared common values in the middle of these really thorny issues. So the two issues specifically that you called out were immigration and cannabis. So let's start with immigration. Let's start with the shared common values around immigration. We remember that we are a nation, besides the first peoples that lived here, we are a nation of primarily immigrants. We're a melting pot. We look at the historical cultural benefit of immigration and look at how our diverse fabric as a country formed us together. And then I think we also look at the economic benefit of immigration for some of our state's most important industries, namely agriculture, which I'm part of. And so if we can start there, we can come off the ledges of polarization. We can start saying, hey, there are some shared common values around the benefits that immigrants bring to our society. And then we move outwards and we move looking towards, how do we find solutions? We've been trying in Congress, they've been trying to get comprehensive bipartisan immigration reform passed since George W. Bush was president, right? This is a complex and thorny issue. But I think if we start recognizing the value of immigration, then we can slowly move outwards and find solutions. I believe in protecting family reunification. I believe in protecting our DACA and our TPS recipients. I believe in working to fix the visa backlog. And I also believe in supporting the institution building work of the State Department in our Latin American countries. Currently, our State Department has been systematically gutted. We don't have a functioning field presence in most of the world. And that's limiting our ability to help build up the governments and the institutions in Latin America. I believe when we look across our southern border, most of us see economic migrants. But through the human rights work I've gotten to do in Latin America, the research of the organization that I'm affiliated with, Cristosal, they've shown that most of the people crossing our southern border actually are refugees and have an asylum claim. And so how do we reframe the discussion to say, what are their rights as international refugees? And how can we as a country help their governments build up their institutions to protect their citizens? So the other question you asked about was cannabis, right? And I am starting with those shared common values. Again, for me, looking at the center of that issue, it's about protecting our family farmers, no matter what commodity they grow. And it's about making sure that that we have federal policy that makes sense. The conversation is evolving on this issue, and when more than 20 medical associations, including ones affiliated with the U.S. government, say that cannabis has a medical benefit, it's pretty silly to me that it's a Schedule I drug. And so making sure that we work to deschedule cannabis so that reflects today's best science about what the plant is used for, and then making sure that we're supporting our family farmers and supporting our state as they roll out the regulations, the complex regulations across the supply chain, to make sure that we're able to keep as much of those tax dollars as we can in our counties to really boost our county budgets.
And did you want to chime in about abortion and firearms and the latitude that states should have?
Yeah, you're just throwing them all at me right now. Let's talk about everything. Did you want to know my specific issue, question, or thoughts on those issues, or were you more talking about states?
Yeah, in relate to the, it was the same question, that illegal immigration and cannabis, as well as abortion and firearms being wedge issues, and where you stand on each of those, and then how much latitude should individual states have to set their own rules?
Mm-hmm. I firmly believe in a woman's right to make her own reproductive choices. And that has been outlined in Supreme Court cases in the past, and that is enshrined in our law. Firearms, I grew up on a family farm. I grew up in a family that safely and responsibly used firearms to protect our livestock, to protect our crops. There was a fall when the wine grapes were just about ready, and we had a herd of 80 wild boar coming through, and they were devastating the grape crop. They were eating really well, but my dad had to get a special permit, and we had to abate the pest, and we ate more carnitas that fall than anyone ever wanted to. And my dad is a sportsman, and so I understand and I value farmers, ranchers, and sports enthusiasts need to have the tools that they need. That said, there is a lot that we can do on a federal level to protect our citizens until other states will get their state gun safety laws up to where Californians are. It's fascinating to me because the center part that we're talking about shared common values, right? The shared common value on the gun issue is whether you are a gun enthusiast or you don't think they have any role in society, the middle part there is that no one wants innocent lives taken at the hands of guns. And we've made a lot of progress here in California. Since 1993 to 2016, gun violence rates dropped by 56% in California and only 16% around the rest of the world. Rest of the country. And so at a federal level, there are things we can do now to keep people safe, including making our background check system truly universal, banning bump stocks and binary triggers, increasing our gun violence protection order, restraining order system to a more federal level. And there's a lot that we can do right now to keep people safe that falls squarely in the middle around those shared common values.
All right. The North State differs from the rest of California in many ways. What is the most critical? Oh, wait, we'll take a little. You can. There are four more left. The North State differs from the rest of California in many ways. What is the most critical challenge that the North State faces, and how would you help address this challenge?
It is different up here. It's different in Northern California than it is in the rest of the state, and we don't share a lot of the affluence that is spread around our beautiful state. When you're up here, California's first district is 11 counties, and 7 of the 11 counties are in the 15 poorest in the state. Yet we are home to the Headwater region. This is where all of the water falls. This is where all of our beautiful, or so much of our beautiful forestry land is. And so we're rich in resources, and yet we're poor. And folks up here feel forgotten, and we feel left behind by Sacramento and by Washington. And And for good reason, because we have been. And so for me, as I've been when traveling around, I've been so fortunate to be a full-time candidate and to be able to get to every corner of our district and meet with people and learn about their situations. And the most pressing issue, the common thread that I've seen in all of our 11 counties, is that our economies are stagnated. Our counties, some of our counties are almost bankrupt. Some of our cities are almost bankrupt. There's not money in the county budgets because there's not the tax base. Up in Modoc County has almost 80% public lands, and there's not the tax base to provide funding for that county to take care of its citizens. You get out to some of our more rural areas in Lassen County, in Shasta County, and you're seeing the same thing. Good people at the county level wanting to make sure that they have public safety offices that are fully staffed, wanting to make sure that they can hire school therapists and social workers to work at their school to take care of the kids who are coming in. But there's just not the money. And so as your representative, my key priority would be looking at innovative ways to boost our rural economies, to build that tax base, to make sure that there is the funding at the county level for people to do the good work. A couple of key ways that we can do that are investing in sustainable forestry practices that and using the wood that we can take out of the forest for new innovative products, really investing in that industry, investing in the infrastructure around here in the North State, especially our cell infrastructure and our rural broadband. There are cities or towns rather in our district where you can't get an internet connection anymore. I went up to Greenville. I was in Greenville a few weeks ago, and a small business owner said, I got the last internet port in downtown Greenville, and that was a year ago. So no new business has been able to come into Greenville in the last year because they don't have the internet infrastructure. And these are things we're sitting here in the Valley in Chico. These are things that we don't think about. We don't deal with every day, but they're realities for our residents and our business owners around the district. So those are a couple ideas of how we can get our economic engines going around here in our rural district.
Our region is the source of much of the state's water supply. Do you think there's anything wrong with the current system? And what is your stance on the current water infrastructure proposals, such as raising the height of Shasta Dam and building a reservoir at sites and the Delta bypass tunnels?
Oh, water. We could talk about water all day long. But let's start by talking about and remembering that California's Constitution declares that water is a public trust resource. It's Article 10. And what that means to me is that water should be used to benefit the people and bring the most good to the public. So when we're thinking about water on a broad scale, it's important to remember that our climate is changing. And we are going to have really heavy rainfall years, and we are going to have a lot of drought years. So looking down the pipe, we need to be investing in an innovative and a flexible water infrastructure system at a state level. I believe in conservation before infrastructure, and I always believe in repairing old infrastructure before building new infrastructure. But we also really, really need to be looking in our part of the world at our land management and how we manage our land, what impact that has on collecting and capturing our rainwater. And so we mentioned already the Headwaters region, right? All of this water falls in our forests and in Northern California. But when our forests are so densely populated, so densely crowded, the water doesn't, and the snowpack in the water doesn't get to the ground, doesn't infiltrate, doesn't fill up the aquifers and the underground water storage areas as much as if we had a better maintained ecosystem. So that's one thing to think about. Specifically, you called out three different infrastructure projects. Let's break them down one at a time. Raising the Shasta Dam. If raising the Shasta Dam would make it rain more, I'd be all for it. But the fact of the matter is, in the last 10 or so years, Shasta has only filled and spilled four times. And so spending $3-ish billion of taxpayer money to yield 60,000 more acre feet a year doesn't seem like a good investment of resources. There are also some cultural sites and some endangered species issues with that particular project. But for me, the bottom line is dollars and cents. Yield, we're talking a yield increase of that little. That's not even, that's so far away. We measure water in million acre feet, right? MAF. That's 600 or 60,000 acre feet is what they're estimating that yield increase would be a year. Doesn't seem like a wise investment. Sites Reservoir, you're thinking the location of that reservoir is not ideal geographically. It's sitting on top of a bunch of fault lines, and it's also in the rain shadow coming across the mountain. And so there would be a lot of evaporation from there. And the fact of the matter, when you look at California's water infrastructure map, there aren't any more good places for reservoirs because the good places have already been taken. They were built in the 60s, right? We looked a long time ago at the best places to build in, and we've built them all. I think underground water storage in the sites area might make a lot of sense, but we need to keep being more and more innovative. Thinking about things like putting solar panels down the California Aqueduct to reduce evaporation and to create energy, to put turbines in our pipes as we're pumping water, so we're creating electricity while we're moving our water around. And there's a lot of really innovative things that we can do. The last one you mentioned was the tunnels, correct? I'm skeptical about the tunnels because of the environmental impact that'll have on the Delta. But mostly I'm skeptical about the tunnels because that seems like it's going to make it a lot easier to transfer our water south. And I believe, you know, the Metro Irrigation District, there's a lot of people in LA that need water. And Southern California would not exist in its present form if it was not for our water transfers and our water projects. But the way that the system is set up right now, people are selling water. Our private irrigation districts, our state water contractors are selling water. Guess who's getting rich? Selling the public's water. It's not me. I'm looking at Mark. I don't think it's Mark either. The richest of the rich are padding their pockets because they're selling water, and that just doesn't seem fair to me. And so I'm skeptical of what the tunnels will continue to do to that system. And we really just, we need to be looking holistically at our state as a whole. How do we meet our water needs? How do we recharge our aquifers? How does land use come into that? It's a complex issue that we could talk about for, I don't know, another 45, 50 minutes if you wanted to, but I think we'll wrap it up there.
All right. Thank you so much. Homelessness has become an entrenched problem for most communities, but remedies are elusive. What effective measures might be taken at the federal level to end homelessness?
Yeah, man, we are seeing that so, so much around our district. And it's a confluence of factors, right? There is an affordable housing crisis in all of California. I was just over in Oroville last week, and they told me that in Oroville, of the renting population, of the people who rent their homes, 60% of those people spend more than half their income on rent and utilities. 60%! In Chico, I think I learned that it was closer to 35, 39 in Chico. But those numbers are staggering. And so there's an affordable housing component of it, right? And there's been a lot of great ideas locally about investing in tiny houses, investing in community housing type options. There's been a lot of talk about how do we provide holistic solutions to the homeless population? How do we make sure that we're not just looking at the housing issue, but we're also looking at job training. We're also looking at mental health treatment when necessary. We're also looking at meeting other basic needs. At a federal level, I see my role on this issue the same way I see my role on a lot of issues, which is finding and securing federal funding and then giving local control to the people in our county who are who are working on these issues and doing it well. Because homelessness looks different in Chico than it does in Alturas, than it does in Redding, than it does in Etna. But I've talked to and seen it in all of those places. So making sure that we are getting the resources to the communities and then staffing up and allowing the people who are on the ground doing the work to do the good work they do.
All right, here we go. It's the last question. Congress is entrusted with the power of the purse, budgeting and spending public money. What policy areas and programs do you think deserve more money, and what would be the source of that money?
Great question. And I feel like I've spent my entire half an hour interview talking about all of the things that I want to spend money on, which is absolutely true. There's two things that we can do to get more money at a federal level, and it is fix the broken tax code system that overwhelmingly gave tax cuts to the wealthiest among us and corporations to make sure that there is still money in the federal coffers for things like Social Security and Medicare. But also, I think that there's a lot that we can do in terms of reallocating some of the $716 billion that we spend on defense every year. So I am absolutely a proponent for making sure that our military is ready and making sure that we are taking care of our servicemen and women while we're deploying them, and then especially after as when they're coming home as veterans. But there is a lot of room in that $716 billion to reallocate some of that money to some of our critical domestic priorities, like healthcare, like education, like taking care of the homeless population, everything that we've been talking about, like making sure that we have money in our Social Security coffers to take care of people once they retire, making sure that we're investing in some of these things that really are the fabric of our society, making sure that everyone can live a dignified life. And I think we've talked a lot about my spending priorities, but I really, really believe that if we have a fair tax code and if we look carefully at our defense spending, there is and will be room in the federal budget to make sure that our critical domestic priorities are taken care of.
Agriculturalist and educator and candidate for California's first congressional district, Audrey Denny, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mark.